Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, David Onick. Our topic this hour is the future for San Francisco families. With home prices rising 25% in the last year, with astronomical rents and crowded neighborhoods, it's no surprise that many San Francisco families are struggling to stay in the city. At the same time, renewed job growth and improving public schools make San Francisco a place where more parents want to raise their children. How are housing, employment, education, and other forces impacting families in the city at all income levels? What can policymakers do to help families stay in San Francisco? Which families are most vulnerable in the city's booming real estate market? Joining us in studio to discuss these issues are three Bay Area guests. Egon Terplan is the Regional Planning Director at SPUR. SPUR is a member-supported nonprofit that promotes good planning and good government in the Bay Area through research, education, and advocacy. Egon brings more than 14 years of experience in economic development, transportation, and government reform to SPUR, and has worked on economic development for Mayor Giuliani in New York and as a public school teacher on Rikers Island. Welcome, Egon. Christina Canaveral is a director of parent organizing and education policy at Coleman Advocates for Children and Youth. Coleman is a member-led, multiracial community organization working to create a city of hope, opportunity, and justice for all children and families in San Francisco. Christina was born and raised here in the Excelsior District and has a strong background in program management and youth development, having worked for the Bernal Heights Neighborhood Center and the Upward Bound program of the University of Central Florida. Welcome to the program, Christina. And Jed Kolko is Chief Economist and Vice President of Analytics at Trulia. Trulia is a real estate information company headquartered in San Francisco that offers apps for renters, mortgage seekers, and agents, and attracts more than 35 million unique house hunters every month to its website. In Jed's prior role as Associate Director and Research Fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California, he led research projects and advised policymakers and business leaders on economic, housing, and technology policies. Welcome, Jed. So let's start with some basic facts about families in San Francisco so we can really understand what we're talking about here. An often cited fact is that San Francisco has fewer school-age children than almost any other major city in the U.S. In the Bay Area, we're much lower than our neighboring cities, with only 13% of San Francisco residents being children, compared to 25% in San Jose and 21% in Oakland. Egon, what's behind these lower numbers in San Francisco?
Well, I think one thing you have to keep in mind when you think about the lower percentages for San Francisco is that it's a reasonably small city on a relative scale. And it's a major job center. So certainly those numbers have changed a little bit over time. But if you compared San Francisco, say, for example, to Manhattan, which is just a borough within a larger city, the numbers are much more similar. So part of it is is thinking about San Francisco as part of a much bigger region. Oakland is a place that certainly a lot of folks live in Oakland, work in San Francisco, move back and forth. San Jose, in contrast, actually in many ways is in large part a bedroom community, and it's one of their major economic challenges is try to bring more jobs there as a particular city. So it's not surprising that they have a much larger percentage of children than we do here.
Christina, is it surprising to you the low number of children in San Francisco?
I mean, I think it's surprising to me in difference to when I was a kid in San Francisco. Just looking at McLaren Park, which is right behind us, I was there maybe about 2 months ago, and I saw, I think, three times the amount of dogs than I saw of children. And so that to me is pretty scary.
We do have plenty of dogs here in San Francisco.
Yes,
there's no question about that. Now, these numbers are not only low, but they've been declining. There are 8,000 fewer children here now than there were 10 years ago. Jed, do you have a sense of what's behind the recent decline in children in San Francisco?
Well, first of all, it's not just the number of children here. It's also the age of the children. One thing that we look at is looking at how many 0 to 4-year-old kids there are compared to 5 to 9-year-old kids. There are more 0 to 4-year-old kids, which means that parents tend to move out of the city as their kids reach school age. Now, where are they going? When you look to a lot of suburban school districts, that's where you see a lot more school-age kids than you see the preschool-age kids. One of the things, of course, that's accelerated this is rising home prices in San Francisco and the Bay Area more generally. Even though prices, of course, fell in San Francisco and in the Bay Area after the housing bubble burst, prices are now up almost 20% year over year in San Francisco itself, and even more in some of the more affordable parts of the Bay Area in the East Bay. What really sets the Bay Area apart from other parts of the country is not only that the city is so expensive, but also a lot of the suburbs are expensive too. So the most expensive parts of San Francisco aren't quite as expensive as the most expensive parts of Manhattan. But the more affordable suburbs around New York are much cheaper than the more affordable suburbs around San Francisco.
And what is the implication of that for a young family with a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old just reaching that age where you were saying more and more families are leaving? Where does that leave them?
The choices are tough. It means moving out. It might mean moving out even farther than you would in a less expensive city. It might mean a second or a third job. It might mean living in a much smaller place than you would otherwise. I mean, one way in which people across the world deal in very expensive markets is to live in a smaller place than they would otherwise. And certainly people in San Francisco live in much less space than people in most other parts of the country.
And Egon, could you comment on that from what you're seeing? How are the huge prices affecting young families in San Francisco?
Well, I wanted to pick up on two trends that just came up from Jeb was saying. I mean, first, there's certainly families that are choosing to live in smaller spaces. And I think, in a sense, that's something we should embrace. We are embracing a younger demographic or a broader change of people being willing to live in urban environments without as much space. For traditionally, cities were saying, well, we need to compete with suburban areas and try to offer the same type of housing as there. And there were arguments over the years about that. But if people are choosing to raise families in apartments, that's a good thing. We've seen that in New York for a long time. But the implication of the other part that Jed was mentioning about people moving out is they fundamentally change their transportation patterns. That if you live in New York City and you live in Manhattan and move out to a borough, you're staying within the same basic transportation network, and your job presumably is still going to be connected on the subway system. In the Bay Area, that's not the case. If you're in San Francisco and you move out to a suburban environment, unless your job is in downtown San Francisco, very likely you're going to then have to purchase another automobile as part of the household in terms of getting back to and from work. So it really starts to then change the pattern of how people move around the region.
Not only are home prices up, Christina, but rents are also going through the roof here. How is that impacting low-income families here in San Francisco?
Right. I mean, I think it's impacting them greatly, and I think that it really speaks to sort of a larger story in terms of who is really leaving San Francisco and who is choosing to leave for, you know, a different school, or if they want, you know, a bigger backyard, and who's actually being forced out of San Francisco, right? Because their rent has tripled or they've been evicted. And more often than not, those that are being pushed out are low-income working class families of color.
So let's talk about that group for a moment, because I think there are distinct groups that are all leaving, right? And the low-income communities of color, working class folks, let's take African Americans for starters. Just a dramatic decrease. I believe the latest numbers show a 36% decrease in the African American population in San Francisco in the past 20 years, now representing only 6% of the city population. What is going on there, and what can we do to keep African American families in San Francisco?
I mean, I think it's a combination of making sure that there are good middle wage jobs. In San Francisco, right now, what we're seeing is a huge increase in low-wage service jobs and then very high-end sort of the creative class jobs. So first thing is we need to make sure that all people in San Francisco are able to work and actually have a self-sufficient wage. And then the other part would be making sure that there's affordable housing, that enough affordable housing to make sure that everyone is able to live in the city that they call home.
And what about another group, Jed, which are folks who are maybe college educated, working in social services or nonprofits, but they just find, as you were saying, as their kids get to be a certain age, it's often as they start to enter the school system that more and more of those families are moving out. What can be done to keep them in? We'll get to our schools shortly, but public schools are improving in San Francisco. More people are signing up, but it still seems like so many families right at that point of entering school, that's when they decide to move out.
People move out of San Francisco and also of other cities. It's not just San Francisco that people move out of when their kids reach school age, partly because of schools, but also for more space. I mean, when around the time that kids reach school age is also the time that a lot of parents decide that they want more space indoor and outdoor if they can for their kids. So the types of neighborhoods that we see families with kids reaching school age moving to do tend to be those with higher rated school districts, but also areas that tend to be lower density, They also tend to be a bit more affordable, because if you need more space, you're going to look for a neighborhood where that doesn't cost as much. The trade-off often turns out to be the commute. A lot of parents essentially end up making the choice between their kids' school and their own commute.
It's an interesting point about that, because actually on a national level, there's a lot of people that make a location decision to move further out to get more affordable housing throughout the United States, but then don't always factor in the additional transportation costs associated with that.
Right.
And so there's a lot of discussion of trying to look at those decisions through both housing plus transportation costs as a better measure for affordability. Now, certainly San Francisco is extremely high on the housing cost charts, but it's actually quite low on the transportation cost perspective if someone's travel can take place primarily within San Francisco. And that's not always factored in when people make the decisions to leave the city.
Right. And I think that that also speaks to another option that a lot of low-income families have. If they can't choose between a commute or a school, what ends up happening is families doubling, tripling, and even quadrupling up in really small spaces in order to stay in San Francisco because the access to transportation to their job is necessary.
I want to pick up on that point because I saw some recent data showing that that is increasing quite dramatically in terms of the number of families doubling up. I guess they count that by seeing if there's someone in a household who is not the main householder by census terms or what have you. How real is that? Do you have a sense of the numbers of that?
So much of this is because of the recession, and a lot of it is young adults living at home with their parents. That went up a lot during the recession, and it actually hasn't changed very much. Young people really haven't started moving out of their parents' homes, and this is a national trend.
Sure.
And that's one of the factors, one of the ways in which, you know, the housing market really depends on the overall recovery. Young people are still way behind where they were before the recession in terms of having jobs in the first place and making enough to move out of their parents' homes. And even those who can, many of them are saddled with a lot of student debt. So, you know, not only are they not saving for a down payment, they may be in no position even to make the rent.
I think you're certainly also seeing that in the rental market. Families are not that if landlords are willing to do it, someone might be able to take a one bedroom and have two adults living in it, treating it as a two-bedroom. It's a way to manage the increase in costs. Families are not.
And Christina, what about actually multiple families living together rather than just adult children moving back in?
So I don't know the exact numbers. What I can tell you is from my own personal experience that I don't know if it's drastically moved up or not, but my entire life, there were additional family members living in my house. And when we lived in an apartment building, the apartment below ours had about eight people in a one-bedroom apartment, and we're talking about 2002, 2003. So this isn't a new trend, particularly for low-income families. We have a parent member that just the other day told me that one of her friends recently got evicted, and so she's now given up half of her small one-bedroom so that that lady doesn't stay out in the street.
Jed, you had a further point on this?
I think people who don't rent probably have lost sight of the fact that even during the recession and the housing crash, when home prices fell so sharply, rents kept going up. And so, you know, there was a point, 2009, 2010, when buying in San Francisco became more affordable than it had been in many, many years, both because prices fell so much and also because mortgage rates became so low. But rents were rising throughout that whole period. So that affordability moment was great if you were the sort of family that had a down payment, could qualify for a mortgage, and could buy at that moment. But lots of people were far from ever even being able to ask the question of whether they could take advantage of relatively low prices and low mortgage rates.
This is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're discussing the future for San Francisco families with our guests, Egon Terplan, Regional Planning Director at SPUR, Christina Canaveral, Director of Parent Organizing at Coleman Advocates, and Jed Kolko, Chief Economist at Trulia. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. Are you a parent struggling to stay in San Francisco? Has your family been affected by the city's skyrocketing real estate prices? What are the concerns you have for your San Francisco family? The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. or you can email us at cityvisions917@gmail.com. That's cityvisions917@gmail.com, or post a comment on our website, klw.org, or on our Facebook page. And we'll be getting to those callers shortly. I want to talk some about the job market, which has been raised here. Unemployment in San Francisco is quite low right now, 5.6% as of last week, compared to almost 9% for the state and over 7% in many of the surrounding counties. How is this impacting families in San Francisco? Aegon.
Well, I think the first standpoint of a rising job market is an incredibly positive sign. If we went from 10% now to 5%, there's been an incredible number of jobs created. San Francisco, on a national scale, is one of the counties that absolutely stands out for a huge amount of job growth. Now, Christine alluded to, I think, part of the challenge that we're facing generally as a region, which is a fair chunk of job growth at the upper end of the employment, a lot of job growth at the lower end, and less job growth in the middle. And some research that we're involved in right now is trying to look at the kind of quality of a lot of those middle wage jobs. They're there, but a lot of them are actually jobs that are based on replacement, meaning retiring baby boomers and other people leaving the jobs become an opening. And so that really then becomes the opportunity to make sure that this isn't necessary just for families. It might be younger people coming out of the school system have the right skills to get into those jobs.
Can you give some examples of what those middle jobs are?
Certainly. Well, there's a number of jobs there are actually in sales, which is not a particular industry, but it cuts across the board in a number of places. There's jobs in professional services that are middle skill jobs. There's jobs in transportation, warehousing, logistics, less in San Francisco, certainly, than other places. Advanced manufacturing is an area where there's a little bit of growth, not huge amount of jobs generally. And then, of course, healthcare and construction are really the two big fields where there's a fair number of jobs. And those industries themselves have a pretty well-defined career pathway for someone to come in and have upward mobility.
And what's making it difficult for someone to, say, enter that healthcare field that is really booming here in the Bay Area?
Well, I think there's lots of people who are certainly coming into healthcare, and there are a lot of pathways into that. It's healthcare, interestingly enough, the Bay Area, it's booming, but it's sort of booming everywhere. Healthcare is a national, we spend a lot of money on healthcare. And so in San Francisco, there's in a sense, there's people coming in from all over the region that are coming into work in healthcare jobs in San Francisco. But it definitely is an opportunity to move in.
I would like to add a point around the 5.6 unemployment. I think that in the last 2 years, we've seen an incredible decrease in the unemployment. But I think I would also add just the simple phrase that the devil's in the details, right? The unemployment does not look at people that are partially underemployed, that are only working part time. We also have to look at, what do we consider a good job? Is a good job that pays minimum wage, that's only 30 hours? Does it provide health benefits, time to, paid time off, things like of that nature? So 5.6 sounds really fantastic, but when you dig a little bit deeper, additionally, when you break down the unemployment by neighborhood in San Francisco, you'll also find that 5.6 will vary. In Bayview, it's over 10%.
But just one point, sort of back to San Francisco, and here, this is where San Francisco actually stands out on a national level. We have a much higher minimum wage than any other place. New York City, we've talked about some. The minimum wage is I believe, below $8 an hour. In San Francisco, it's well over $10 an hour. So there are many other neighborhoods in New York, but San Francisco also has provisions for paid sick leave, and we have a citywide health insurance, which exists. So there's some factors that we've put in through policy measures that do make San Francisco a little bit different, even from surrounding cities.
Yeah.
A couple things. First of all, the growth of jobs, primarily at the higher end and lower end, with less in the middle, is a trend that's much bigger than San Francisco. That is now a long-running national trend that is rooted in part with globalization and in part because of technology. And I think, in thinking about the future of San Francisco, it's important to, to the extent it's possible, to try to parse out what are the trends that are actually at least somewhat within local control and things that are less likely to be within local control. The reason for that is in order to be able to focus on things that you can actually affect locally. And a lot of the job patterns are really much bigger than any one place. I think the other point, though, is one of the things that holds back job growth in San Francisco is Real estate. Businesses need real estate just as residents do. And one of the things that makes San Francisco less economically competitive than other places and than it might be is that it's expensive for businesses to locate here also. Many do. Many find that it's worth being here to take advantage of the skilled workforce and other reasons in order to pay the higher real estate costs and higher wages that they're paying to be here. But the high overall cost of real estate not only is an issue for people who want to live here, but also affects how many and the types of businesses that can locate here, too.
You know, we were discussing the minimum wage earlier, and Christina, I'd like to ask you, we do have a higher minimum wage here, but can a family really survive in San Francisco on minimum wage?
Not at all. There has been a map that the San Francisco Public Health Department recently published online that shows exactly how many minimum wage jobs you need in order to rent in certain parts of San Francisco, and I did jot down some of those. In the Mission District, you actually need about 5.5 minimum wage jobs in order to rent there. And then in South of Market, it's 7.4 jobs. So, you know, even at $10.55 an hour, you know, you have to be superwoman to be able to work 5.5 jobs.
So, Egon, if these service jobs are increasing, but they might be minimum wage jobs, how does that help families stay here if you can be a full-time worker and still not be able to afford to stay here?
Well, I think part of the idea is that because there's a minimum wage that's a little bit higher, that in a sense bumps everything up. We're not going to sit around here and make an argument that one can survive easily on that particular minimum wage, but I think we just need to acknowledge that San Francisco has tried things that are a little bit different. I think the real challenge, though, is for people wherever they are on the wage scale is to provide a pathway for them to move upward. So Jed was talking about there's not a lot that we can control locally to make there to be more middle wage jobs. Little bit we can do at the regional scale, not very much we can do in San Francisco. But there's certainly things that we can do to make sure that the people who are here get access to those jobs, that they have the opportunity when someone leaves that profession to move into it. And those are the kinds of things that we have.
How can we help?
Well,
them
so
do that?
Let me just give you one example of something that we're really at the very early stages about. It's a whole rethinking happening of our high school system around connecting high schools to jobs, to career technical education is a word, linked learning is a term that's being used. We are not doing a very good job of teaching children in high school a career path that they could get coming out of high school. So that's something San Francisco is just starting to work on. There's a lot of school districts in the region that are doing that.
What else? Other ideas, Jed, to try to help overcome this problem?
I think a lot of this ultimately is rooted in housing and the cost of living here. One of the things that we haven't talked much about so far is why housing is so expensive in San Francisco in the first place. And part of the answer is God wanted San Francisco to be expensive. If she didn't, she wouldn't have put San Francisco in the middle between oceans on one side, bay and the mountain on the other, with excellent weather. So we're destined to have tight supply because there's not a lot of land to build on and high demand. We aggravate that with regulations that make it hard to build new housing. But even in the absence of that, San Francisco would be an expensive place to begin with. You know, if our government had lots of money in order to build lots of new housing or to support people to move into the housing that exists, it would be easier to make housing more affordable. But we don't have a government that has all that money to make it more affordable for people to live here.
Still, historically, it has been more affordable for working class families to live here over the years.
There was a time roughly around the 1970s, when prices in San Francisco and the rest of California really started to take off from the rest of the country. One of the things that also happened around that time, of course, was Prop 13, which was a response to that. But it was also a time at which that San Francisco had grown enough that it became much harder to build new housing. And it's really been a challenge since then. There have been times since then when housing has become relatively less affordable. But it's easy to forget how different it is from the rest of the country. An 1,800 square foot house or apartment, which is big by San Francisco standards, that's still below the national average of housing units. Costs more than half of the average monthly wage here. It costs about 10% of the average monthly wage in Houston or Dallas or Atlanta. The gap is so big in terms of affordability of what housing costs versus what wages pay here.
And those are actually big cities, too. They're not for that comparison.
That's right. Those are big cities with jobs across much of the income distribution and skill level, where housing is just, you know, many times more affordable.
Let's take a quick break. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're discussing the future for San Francisco families with our guests, Egon Terplan, Regional Planning Director at SPUR, Christina Canaveral, Director of Parent Organizing at Coleman Advocates, and Jed Kolko, Chief Economist at Trulia. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. Are you a parent struggling to stay in San Francisco? What are the concerns for your San Francisco family? The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions917@gmail.com or post a comment on klw.org or on our Facebook page. Christine, I believe you had a comment as we were going to break that you wanted to come in with, so please go for it.
Actually, I just wanted to say that I completely agree. You know, the powers that be, pretty, you know, as a San Francisco native, the powers that be definitely made, you know, San Francisco to be probably the best city in the world. But I do think that there is some things around housing that we could do locally. And I think that the government does have the possibility to have more money in order to assist folks that need that assistance in looking for more affordable housing and building more affordable housing. But sometimes our priorities lie in a different place. And so when we give tax breaks to larger companies to move in, and with them the workers that come in and raise up the rent, we're intentionally prioritizing business over access to affordable housing. And that can sometimes be an issue as well.
Egon and then Jed.
Well, one thing, as I can say, is something that SPUR worked on in the last couple of years is actually creating a permanent source for affordable housing in San Francisco, that redevelopment agencies have a long history in the state and a controversial history in San Francisco. But one of the really big things they did was provide a significant amount of funding for affordable housing on a statewide level. And
can I just interrupt quickly to say, what does it mean with the latest on redevelopment agencies in California? How does that impact all this?
Well, the latest, there are no redevelopment agencies
left in California.
Yes. They were the source of, but they had access to funding to put into affordable housing. That was all gone. San Francisco figured out a mechanism to reclaim some of the portion of that money that through the property tax that otherwise would have gone to the state to be able to use and bond against it for producing affordable housing. So little things like that. But I think, again, we have to acknowledge it's an incredibly important step. But the scale at which we need housing production and production of housing that's affordable to the wages here is quite large. And just as a kind of a simple note, people, we've been talking a lot about the rapid increase in housing costs in San Francisco. We gained something like 25,000 jobs over a year and produced something like 2,500 housing units. The number of housing permits, Jed can probably speak to now, certainly going up on a temporary level. But if your housing production is not keeping up with your job growth, there's no surprise that housing costs skyrocket in a very short period of time.
Jed.
Once you start walking around San Francisco and looking at where you might build more housing, it is shocking how many low-density areas there are that could actually be excellent places for more housing.
Give us some examples.
So start walking around, for instance, BART stations, where the access, whether it's jobs or housing on top of a BART station, is a way to bring more people or jobs into the city who don't need to rely on cars everywhere. Start walking around at the BART stations and see, you know, are they all high density? Do we all see buildings on all four corners of the intersection where that BART station is? Lots of other cities build that way. When we look at models in D.C., even L.A., that, you know, in some ways is good lessons for us to learn about transit. There are little mushrooms of jobs and housing buildings along every transit station. We can point to transit stations here where we don't see that yet. And that's a natural place to look first, to build buildings for housing or jobs or both.
Christina.
That's actually interesting that you say that, because there's a alliance of neighborhood groups in District 11, which includes the Excelsior, which is Communities United for Health and Justice. And the youth in that alliance are currently working to get affordable housing right by the Balboa BART station, behind the BART station, there's like a parking lot, and it's completely underutilized land. And they've had several community meetings. They've had the people that would actually most benefit from that affordable housing come and talk and mitigate some of like the possible, you know, like pollution problems, transportation problems, and really have like a community vision around that. And they've shopped it around to the mayor's office of housing, to BART, to MTA, and it looks like it's finally in the works. So
how could SPUR or Trulia help with a community partnership like that?
Well, SPUR's been involved with a, kind of a number of cases of looking at. We don't do as much kind of local neighborhood work, although we did some community outreach work, particularly looking at the Central Subway and in Chinatown and a couple of those places there. But that's an area where it's very difficult to add significant amounts of new development. That where these other areas we're talking about, there's vacant land. But I think a lot of it really has to do with the perspective that San Franciscans, if they truly care about this being a city that provides opportunity in the future for families and for other people, cities grow and change and they evolve. And if San Francisco doesn't accept, or certain areas really don't accept that growth and that change, this is the circumstance we're going to be in, is kind of what we have right now, where you have very limited supply growth in housing, and when you have an economic boom like this, things skyrocket. Same is true on a job standpoint as well. I mean, office rents are going up very high, and people think that San Francisco has always done everything it can to bring in jobs, which isn't actually true. We have a cap on the amount of employment from office space that can come in on an annual basis. So there's a lot that we do that makes it more difficult to respond to things as economic circumstances change.
Does it have to be an either or? You often hear in this town there are people who are pro-tech boom or anti-tech boom. Is there a way to plan a city that takes advantage of all the advantages that the tech boom is bringing us, but also finds a way to preserve housing for the families, that the low-income families that have been here for generations? Why does it seem in San Francisco it's always us against them rather than figuring out how we can all work together on this issue? Christina, I'll let you take that first.
I mean, I think therein lies sort of the issue of accountability and responsibility that businesses that do, you know, their work here in San Francisco to really invest in the communities that they're going to be working in and, you know, really create a community partnership with the folks that have been here for years.
Jed, what's your thought on that?
So I'm still back on the question of why is it us versus them? And I'm thinking about San Francisco compared to other cities that I've spent a lot of time in and lived many years in. And my sense, actually, for whatever it's worth, is there's a lot less us versus them here than what I saw in Boston or in Washington, D.C. Not that it is easier for families to live in those cities than here, and affordability is more of a challenge here than elsewhere. You know, there are lots of. I think what does set San Francisco apart in some ways is that housing often ends up being the political fault line for lots of issues. You know, there's not. You know, in big political races, it's, you know, rarely Democrats versus Republicans. It's often renters versus owners on lots of issues. How one, you know, one's relationship to one's own housing often has more to do with how you think about the city's political issues than almost any other issue. And I think being in such an expensive city is also a city where balance between renters and owners is more even. Owners are more likely to vote typically than renters are in most places. San Francisco, though, has a more even balance of owners and renters who vote than you have in most other cities. And I think that helps lots of political issues locally line up according to people's housing situations.
Higan, what's your take on this real or perceived divide?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, some of this, though, I come at these as a regionalist, one of the people that tries to think about San Francisco not as an island, but in the context of the Bay Area. And you have the sort of economic boom that's taking place is in many ways a regional phenomenon. There's many parts, not all over the Bay Area do we have this, but there are other cities and communities and counties throughout, particularly San Francisco South and much of what's called Silicon Valley is going through tremendous growth now. And those are areas, as Jeb was saying before, where there's also extremely high housing costs. I think that the reason, what you get to when you start looking at things regionally, is you understand that people are going to make housing choices based on a set of things that's best for them, hopefully, and they're going to make job choices based on the best available job they can get to. And if we had a better functioning regional transportation system, some of these things start to work themselves out a little bit better. For example, if someone makes a decision to leave San Francisco and go to a community in the East Bay, but their job remains connected to BART and they live in a place where they can get to a BART station, their pattern of movement will be similar. They will be maybe a few more minutes on BART, but maybe they get a little bit more housing for less cost. And maybe they get a better school. Maybe they get a, you know, the school situation is a different variable we haven't gotten to yet. But that's one of the great challenges that the Bay Area has relative to other regions. Better than some of the regions you mentioned, but not as good in many ways as Washington or New York metropolitan regions. And so I think there's a lot of opportunity for us to start thinking about these issues in that scale and not just treat it as San Francisco as an island by itself.
And when you think regionally, I think one of the unique things about San Francisco is we have commutes in different directions. In most other major cities, everyone's commuting into the city and then back out. We have a lot of people in my neighborhood, Bernal Heights, and the areas near there commuting down to Silicon Valley for work, just like people from there are also commuting up here. How does that affect this whole situation, kind of the reverse commute and people you know, there are people with jobs down there who are living here and vice versa. That's different than most cities.
Well, I think that's one of the key. We've talked about kind of one of the factors of San Francisco. We are very central in the Bay Area. There's a tremendous number of jobs here. There's a tremendous number of jobs to the south. And so one can make a residential choice to be in San Francisco as a household, maybe with two jobs, and you can get access to a huge array of employment. There's no other place that has that. If you're in the East Bay and in a household with a job in the East Bay and a job on the peninsula, it's very difficult to make that commute pattern. So I think that's one of the factors we're seeing why San Francisco...
That makes San Francisco even more desirable in the Bay Area, because you can work in easy... different counties more easily.
And that's not something we're going to change. It's the patterns are underlaid there.
But I would say that those people making that choice and that have that abundance of being able to know where they live are probably not families. I would say that it might be, you know, a married couple, dual income, no kids, or, you know, single people that can triple up in an apartment. But I don't know if that specific strategy would actually work for families.
Well, I think it depends.
Low income families. High-income families, I think they can choose wherever they want to live.
Well, I actually think this the phenomenon of people living in the city and working in the South Bay and Silicon Valley actually highlights the shortcomings of the broader public transit system here. I mean, the fact that so many of these folks commute via private buses, the Google
buses.
Which
are actually the biggest regional transportation system now, as I understand it, if you take them all together.
I mean, that is filling a gap that the public transit system did not close itself. I think it's showing, you know, the advantage of having a region that is very centered on a part of it like downtown San Francisco, where you have BART coming in from many parts of the East Bay all to that node. What happens when jobs move? It's a lot easier for many employers to move to a new location than it is to rip up or extend or reconfigure a very expensive heavy rail system. And, you know, in the short term, the buses have sort of sprung up to fill that gap. Longer term, if more people want to be living in the city but working in the South Bay, if we start seeing this in other areas around the country, you know, will we decide that the Google buses are the future of American commuting, or does that require a totally different kind of public transit infrastructure investment that we're still a long way from achieving here?
Well, I was about to say, there is not even really talk of that now with the budget problems the state and the region have had in terms of, I mean, the last time we added a BART station in San Francisco was many, many, many years ago. So anyway, you want to get in here.
Well, I'll just say two quick points about that. We're actually, BART is separate from all the kind of labor negotiations. BART's in the midst of a very interesting rethinking of its entire function of being both commuter, railroad, and an urban metro. And so they're going through some thinking about how do they do some investment where the most of the people are riding it. So we could see some infill stations. The other thing I was going to mention, looking out a little bit, looking out 10 years and beyond, Caltrain could eventually eventually become a system that has BART type of service. You electrify Caltrain and you start running at 15-20 minute frequency. Totally transforms the geography. Now, those communities that have Caltrain stations will have to then also be accepting of residential and employment growth around those particular stations. But this is a direction we're going in, that for those people in San Francisco near some of those Caltrain stations, your access to opportunity really increase with the frequency of that kind of service going up.
Sure. Let's take a quick break, and then I want to come back and really get into the school issue that we've touched on but really haven't gotten into in depth. You're listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco. We're on the web at klw.org. Joining us tonight to discuss the future for San Francisco families is Egon Terplan from SPUR, Christina Canaveral from Coleman Advocates, and Jed Colco from Trulia. We invite you to call in with your questions and comments. If you're a parent here in San Francisco trying to decide whether to stay or not, are you affected by the city's skyrocketing real estate prices? Give us a call. Join the conversation at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions917@gmail.com. That's cityvisions917@gmail.com. Or post a comment on klw.org or on our Facebook page. Let's turn now to the schools. Christina Coleman does a lot of work with the schools, a lot of advocacy in the schools. Tell us the role that education and the San Francisco school system is playing in this crisis for families in San Francisco.
Well, I mean, I think, again, it talks to, you know, what families are leaving San Francisco. And so when we look at that, it's what students is the school district failing? Right. Who are they failing in essence? And right now what we know is that San Francisco is the highest achieving urban school district in California, but it's also the school district with the highest racial achievement gap. Right. And so we have Latino and African-American students that are not on track to graduate, that are getting suspended at higher rates than white and Asian students. And then, you know, falling behind, starting from elementary and then all the way up and not graduating or going off to continuation schools. And so When a parent looks at that, that also becomes the choice of whether or not they want their child in a school that's actually failing them.
And what about the possible closure of City College? What effect do you think that will have on families with teenage children looking to go to community college?
Well, you know, City College, a lot of students from SFUSD graduate and go on to City
That's
College,
right.
And not just SFUSD students, but I think we know that City College is, you know, a huge mecca for many working class folks to get additional job training, ESL classes, and things of that nature. So, you know, we can only look forward to see what will happen.
And what is the latest data on schools in San Francisco? You know, it's been reported that there's been a steady decline, but we had some school board members on a couple weeks ago on this program. My understanding is every middle school is completely full except for one middle school in the city. Who can straighten this out for us? Because it seems like there are conflicting reports about what is happening with enrollment in the public schools.
Well, I think, I mean, one of the things we should recognize is the schools went through a very big policy change about how you get into schools. One of the concerns a lot of parents had across income spectrum was the uncertainty about what school their child would get admission to, particularly for kindergarten, but it also affected middle school as well. And they went through something that gave much more neighborhood preference for people to get into schools. So we're only a couple of years into that new policy. But I think there's a piece of that where certainly some people are finding they're now able to make in some ways residential decisions about a neighborhood based on the type of school that's there and their willingness to get into that.
Is it too early to tell what the reaction of families has been to the new system? Or are we already getting some data or some anecdotal information about families being more comfortable with the new system and being more likely to stay? Or do we need more time to really assess that?
Well, I mean, anecdotally, I'm a relatively recent public school parent, and my daughter's in second grade. And of people we know, certainly those that get into a school that they're happy with like the new system. But I observed that some people I know in the past, a number of people we know got none of the schools they were interested in. Certainly people are trying, if they live in a particular neighborhood, are much more likely to put their neighborhood school high up on the list. So anecdotally, from that standpoint, I've seen that. And also the data shows that I believe something like 80% of the applicants get one of their choices. And fairly high percent, 50 to 60%, might get their first choice. So just on that alone, it looks okay, but obviously that means there's a number of people who don't get their first choices, and then some don't get choices at all.
Right, and I also think that transportation also plays a huge role in that, because it also, I think the best schools in San Francisco are on the west side. The highest achieving schools are on the west side. And so for a parent on the southeast side, most likely low income, right, in order to drive their kid all the way to the other side of the city in order to get that high achieving education isn't really a reality.
And this is a huge issue. I would say both transportation ghetto schools, we've cut the school bus program tremendously. Mm-hmm. So that's a huge issue. And then there's the distance. Our schools are not necessarily located near high frequency transit. They just are where they are. Some of them are in buildings that are 80, 90 years old. And so for parents that are taking their children on buses, it's not necessarily correlated well with Muni. And so that becomes a challenge as well, certainly for timing. There's also a wide variety in when schools start. I don't know if people know this, but anywhere from 7:45 to 9:30 are the start times for your school, which is some people don't have control over or when they get to and from work. Many people do. So those are all challenges.
And I just want to highlight one point there, because we've talked a lot about regional transit, but we haven't talked about Muni. And Muni is so crucial to this education part in terms of being able to get from one part of town to another on time to get your kid to school and to get to work.
And I think programs such as Free Muni for Youth, that was a campaign from Power, a community-based organization here in San Francisco, that's rolled out just in this last year, and that has been fantastic and has really helped low-income families be able to afford getting their kids across the city, not just for school, but for after-school programs to go out on the weekend and things like that.
What feedback have you all heard about Free Muni for Youth so far?
Well, I think one of the things that we have to think about is Muni has tremendous needs. It needs to go faster. It needs more money. It needs more investment. So a lot of our attention has really been focused on that. How do we make sure that Muni has the investment and the ability to actually deliver people much more quickly to where they're going? And so that's really the direction we need to go with a lot of this.
Okay, let's go to the phones. And Barbara, welcome to City Visions.
Oh, hi. How are you tonight?
I'm doing well, thanks.
Good. I was wondering if you had ever looked at the Sunset at Richmond District as developing, because it's such low-density housing. That's where I reside.
Okay, you were fading out a little bit, but I think the question was about Sunset and Richmond. There's more room there.
Yes.
Could there be some higher-density housing out in those areas of the city?
Yes.
You want to take that, Jed?
Those neighborhoods have the advantage of being lower density. They are more affordable, though not necessarily the most affordable parts of the city. Transit better in some parts of the western side of the city than others. But that's, again, I think when we think about where we would want more housing on transit would be the first test is what does the transit access look like? Can people get from there to school to a job without being in the car.
Let me ask you about that in San Francisco. Because you talked earlier about BART stations. What BART stations would you envision with this dense housing around it?
In terms of BART stations in the city, there aren't that many. I mean, if you look at I live right near the 16th and Mission mm-hmm. BART station, and if you walk to that station and look at the four corners around the station, most of what you see is 3-2-1 story or unbuilt on land, and when you think about a location that could be so valuable in terms of transit access, whether for jobs or for housing, that's one example. Again, there aren't that many other BART stations, in the city itself.
Right, because most of them are downtown already, yes.
Right.
To the question about the kind of growth in some of the outlying areas, and this is kind of to the crux of one of the very hot-button issues of San Francisco, but two points I wanted to make. One is that John Ram, the planning director, talks about in terms of a lot of the projected growth, 80% of the growth is projected on 20% of the land, and most of that's in the eastern part of the city. Is that the right equation? That's a debatable issue, and I think that this is it's hotly debated, and a lot of people don't want to see growth in the Sunset and the Richmond. But if we want to solve some of the issues we've talked about, those could be good places to grow. And then back to the family question, my daughter's school is near Geary Boulevard, and there's a number of schools up and down Geary. And if you imagine much more frequent good fast transit moving up and down Geary Boulevard, which is somewhat in the works, that becomes a corridor where people, if there's enough housing that's affordable and in the surrounding area, you can get back and forth to a whole wide variety of schools, from the kindergartens all the way up. Certainly there's some of the high schools in that area as well.
And I think there are always going to be competing interests. I mean, when we think about the types of neighborhoods that families who have the choice to be able to move tend to move to, they tend to move to lower density neighborhoods. Part of the appeal of the Richmond or the Sunset for many families might be that it is lower density. And so helping improve one problem could aggravate another one. I think more broadly, one of the challenges in thinking about density and housing and being able to build more housing is the people who live here vote. The people who can't afford to live here aren't voting in San Francisco because they can't afford to live here. And so inevitably, our housing policies, transportation policies favor those who are here versus those who are not. And one very good way to prop up your own home values, if you're an owner, is to make it very hard to build new housing here.
Now, we have an email from James related to this, asking, how will the Transbay Terminal impact San Francisco and families? Will we see more folks commuting from further away? Will we see more high-density housing around the Transbay Terminal?
Well, the Transbay Terminal is currently being built and is hopefully going to become the northern terminus of both California High-Speed Rail as well as extending Caltrain from where it stops right now near the ballpark. There are plans for adding significant new amounts of employment, maybe 15,000 jobs or so, as well as a significant amount of new housing. Will the housing that's built around there be full of families? Probably not. Will that location there make it one such that families or anyone can get access both to San Francisco and from San Francisco to other places? Absolutely. And I think when I talked about Caltrain and envisioning Caltrain at BART service levels in the future, now, this is not a guarantee that it happens, but this is the kind of thing, if we have the vision to move it forward and provide the funding, we are moving on the path in that direction. The opportunities that exist towards the south and other parts of Silicon Valley could certainly become available to more San Francisco families of all income levels.
Let me turn to something unique about San Francisco, which is the set-aside we have for children and youth that creates the Department of Children, Youth, and Their Families. It's ironic that we kind of have this set-aside that almost no other city has, but we have this low population of children. Can you tell us, Christina, about DCYF, about the services it provides, and what those services are doing to help struggling families stay in San Francisco?
Yeah, sure. So I'm sure you know, David, but the Children's Fund was actually a campaign that Coleman led back in 1991 and then again in 2000 to be reauthorized. And again, we will be working on that in 2014 to have it reauthorized again. DCYF provides a lot of things for children, youth, and their families. After-school programs, youth empowerment programs, weekend activities, trainings for child care workers. I mean, the whole gamut. And it's, you know, it really creates what is the children and youth safety net for low-income families in San Francisco, and really, really important to keep.
One thing you mentioned was child care, which hasn't come up so much, but anyone with young children knows that that is so crucial, along with transportation and some of the other things we talked about. What are the child care challenges for families in San Francisco?
I mean, I think a lot of the challenges have to do with the affordability and accessibility of child care. And at the state level, we've seen tremendous cuts to child care. And so what ends up happening is that there's a lot of wait lists for families. And so then they rely on outside family or friends to help take care of their children as they go off to work.
But one thing, I don't know if everyone knows this, but San Francisco actually has a preschool for all program that in the final year before kindergarten, there's reduced rate. Now, it's not, doesn't make it incredibly affordable, but there is a 25% subsidy that's, but it's just that last year. And a lot of people need childcare for more years than that. One topic, actually, that we haven't talked about at all, and maybe this is one way to bring up some positive things, is actually the park department, recreation.
Actually was going to be my next question, so it's a perfect segue.
Well, I was just thinking about it again as a family, a parent in San Francisco, and this is something where there's been tremendous investment over the last number of years in parks and playgrounds. A lot of them for catering to some of that 0 to 4 age children that Jed mentioned.
And there was
before.
A bond that passed that is allowing a lot of playgrounds to be renovated right now.
And there's
now.
Been a number of bonds, and there will likely be more. And so we've done a very good job of sort of managing that moving forward. And it's not just the playgrounds, but there's also a set of activities and recreation centers. And I mean, it's though it doesn't affect some number of people go to it, but something like a Camp Mather, which up near Yosemite, which almost burned down, but didn't recently. You know, thousands of families go there on an annual basis. So there's a few things that a lot of people really cherish about being here, and you wouldn't get if you went to another community.
We just have a few minutes left. I just wanted to give you each a moment or two to try to sum up your thoughts on families and San Francisco. Jed, what would you say the future looks like in the next few years for families trying to decide whether to stay and whether they can stay in the city?
I think a lot of families here in San Francisco face a tough choice. San Francisco is one of the most expensive cities in the country, it is likely to get more expensive as home prices keep rising. They're rising faster than rents are, as mortgage rates keep rising. For those who are thinking of buying, it is only likely to get more expensive over the next year rather than cheaper. So for families, depending on how old their kids are, San Francisco works very well for lots of families before kids reach school age. Many will continue to leave around the time kids reach school age, not only for schools, but also for more space. And again, I think, you know, some of the things that we've talked about, you know, one of the best ways to make housing more affordable, or at least prevent it from getting much less affordable, is to build more. At the same time, for families who want low-density areas, the more housing we build, the fewer of those low-density areas there are.
Got it. Christina, last word. How does Coleman see this issue playing out in the next few years?
I think that for low-income, working-class folks of color, it's not so much a choice, but really a struggle to survive in the city that they call home. And we're really hemorrhaging families right now. We're seeing lots of African-American and Latino and Pacific Islanders families just not really fleeing because that would be a choice, but really just getting pushed out to the outer edges of the city and then just outside of the city. And it's critical that we need to stop it.
Egon, very quickly, you get the final word.
Well, I just think we've talked some about employment and economic opportunities, and I think that's critical. One of the things we're really interested in thinking of is how do you connect people that are in the city to job opportunities going forward. But I also think back to this kind of housing question. A lot of people are choosing urbanism and an urban lifestyle, and I think that's if people are willing to live in smaller places, the benefits of living in an urban area and an urban place are profound, both in employment and access to amenities. And so there's a lot of positive attributes for people that are willing to find the way and the means to stay in San Francisco.
Well, this has been a great conversation. I really want to thank you all for joining us. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
That's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Jed Kolko of Trulia, Christina Canaveral of Coleman Advocates, and Egon Turplin of Spur. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download our podcast, visit the City Visions page on kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was Eric Wayne. Tonight's show was produced by Victoria Thorpe. Join us next Monday for a conversation about coffee. This is David Onick. Thanks for listening to KLW, your local public radio station. Good night and have a great week.